From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Edmund Morris discusses his controversial new biography of Ronald Reagan. It's the first biography authorized by a sitting president, but Morris uses an unprecedented technique. He created a character who is a fictionalized version of the author and a witness to the events of Reagan's life. Also, we meet John Peterman, the founder of the J. Peterman Catalog. He was the basis of the character Peterman on the sitcom Seinfeld. In the latest edition of the Harvard Business Review, Peterman explains how his company went bankrupt. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An Illinois jury has awarded more than $450 million to policyholders with State Farm auto insurance. The suit alleged that State Farm cheated customers by requiring body shops to use substandard repair parts. The insurance company says it will appeal. A State Farm spokesman said its replacement policy didn't compromise safety and saved consumers money with cheaper parts. A number of lawsuits have been filed against State Farm on the same issue, but the Illinois case was the first to come to trial. The judge in the case is expected to rule on two additional consumer fraud counts in the next few days. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the drug testing of classroom teachers and all school employees. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Beginning in 1994, anyone applying for a job with the public schools in Knox County, Tennessee, had to submit to a urinalysis test to check for use of marijuana, cocaine, alcohol, and other drugs. Teachers and administrators protested because the policy included longtime school employees who wanted to take another job within the district. They sued and won in federal district court, arguing that drug testing is unconstitutional unless there's evidence that a teacher or school employee is using drugs. An appeals court reinstated the policy, saying that the drug testing was justified because of the role that teachers and other school personnel play in children's lives and safety. The U.S. Supreme Court dismissed the teachers' arguments, but it did not comment on the case. This means the Knox County Schools drug testing policy can continue until the court takes up another case and offers a final decision on the matter. I'm Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
Some students in Tarboro, North Carolina, say they're relieved they're back in school for the first time in weeks. Massive flooding from Hurricane Floyd has made any kind of normal routine impossible. Mary Hartnett of member station WUNC has more.
When asked how they felt about being back in school after weeks of flooding and devastation, students in Tarboro, North Carolina had mixed feelings. In one senior economics class, students described the last 2 weeks as wet and sad, but some also said they felt relieved and blessed. Students and teachers in the Edgecombe County schools are starting the school year over again, while still recovering from the floods brought on by Hurricane Floyd. Floyd dropped more than 20 inches of rain on eastern North Carolina, and 8 more inches fell last week. 8,000 students were affected by flooding. 2 Edgecombe County schools were destroyed, and many others were damaged. Tarboro High School Gymnasium is still being used as a shelter for flood victims. For NPR News, I'm Mary Hartnett in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 128 points to close at 10,401. This is NPR. Sprint still hasn't given a formal response to competing bids from Bell South and MCI WorldCom. Sprint's the nation's third largest long-distance company and the owner of the second biggest wireless carrier. Top management officials are reported to be reviewing the competing bids. Forensics experts are excavating a former military police base in Guatemala City. They're searching for the remains of thousands of people who disappeared during the 1980s. The BBC's Peter Gresta reports.
The sound of jackhammers has started ringing through the Guatemalan National Police Academy as forensic experts started breaking up the concrete floor of the ladies' room. Underneath, they expect to find the bones of hundreds and possibly thousands of people who disappeared during the country's 36-year civil war, all believed to be victims of the Mobile Military Police Force. A construction worker first discovered the bones when he was installing pipes into the toilets earlier this year. For the past 3 months, investigators have been interviewing some 400 witnesses who say that the base was used as a torture centre and clandestine cemetery for the military police unit. The unit was originally set up as a counterinsurgency force. The investigators have identified two sites at the academy where they believe victims are buried.
The BBC's Peter Gresta. The UN Security Council has increased the amount of oil that Iraq may sell in the latest six-month phase of the Oil for Food program. The Council voted unanimously to raise the amount by more than $3 billion to about $8.3 billion. The additional money is to make up for a shortfall in Iraq's oil revenues caused by low prices. The U.S. has accused the Iraqi government of withholding the oil revenues from the program. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might have expected that a biography of Ronald Reagan would be in the news for its new revelations about the former president. But what's making news is the author himself and the approach he's taken. My guest is Edmund Morris, who spent the past 14 years working on this new biography of Ronald Reagan. Reagan and his staff chose Morris to write the president's biography and gave him access to Reagan and his papers. But for years, in spite of Morris's special access, he felt unable to penetrate Ronald Reagan's inner life. To get around this, Morris came up with the device of creating a fictional narrator, bearing the author's name, Edmund Morris, who was with Reagan at key moments of his life, moments that the real Morris couldn't possibly have been there for. This has set off a heated debate among historians and biographers. In 1980, Morris won the Pulitzer Prize for his biography of Teddy Roosevelt. I asked Morris why he created a fictionalized version of himself instead of just including his subjective observations and conclusions as Reagan's biographer.
Ronald Reagan was a magical phenomenon. I became aware when I was with him that what seemed so ordinary in private, sometimes alarmingly ordinary, transformed within a split second into something magical whenever he stepped out of the public, out of the private arena and into the public. And the mystery of this transformation, which has much to do with the mysteries of theatre, fascinated me. And I knew that I had to devolve a literary device which would convey the phenomenon of Reagan the performer. He was a performer all his life. I'm not being pejorative in calling him a performer. In fact, I admire the thespian community profoundly. But the device had to show his theatrical and cinematic magic.
You admire him as a performer. Did you admire him as a politician and president?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. That's quite obvious to anybody who reads the book.
What are some of the biggest problems President Reagan presented to you as a subject?
His inscrutability, his personal inscrutability, was a major problem because naturally biographers are always concerned about and curious about the inner man. And Ronald Reagan, on first acquaintance, appeared to have no inner man at all. A metaphor that came to me and which I use in the book, I think, is that he was like alabaster, this beautiful polished exterior with visible walls and convolutions beneath the surface, but it was impossible to probe my fingers past that hard gloss outside. And I should explain that the reason that he was so inscrutable was that he was not very curious about himself. He was not a reflective, self-analytical, self-doubting man. He lacked curiosity about himself. He was supremely sure of his rightness and his strength and his vision, and therefore was very difficult to interview.
Well, you write, what you see is what you get, is what several of his intimates had warned you when you asked about his hidden depths. Nevertheless, you say, you couldn't believe how little one got and how shallow those depths appeared to be. Did you find President Reagan to be a shallow person?
Yes and no. The metaphor of the alabaster applies. The surface polish seemed to be shallow. The things that he would say in private were sometimes alarmingly banal. They were so surpassingly ordinary that I couldn't understand how such a man could be the leader of the free world. But as the years went by, and as I began to take him much, much more seriously, and as I began to study the manuscripts that he'd written as a young man, analyze his performances as an actor, read his diaries, talk to those who knew him or who thought they knew him, I realized that this man was revealing more and more and more depths which I had to plumb in some fashion.
Can you give an example of one of your frustrating encounters with him when you were trying to interview him?
I do remember saying to him once, in frustration, that I couldn't understand him. And he seemed genuinely shocked and said, "Why, I'm an open book." And I said, "Yes, Mr. President, but all your pages are blank."
To which he said, "What?"
He was just, Reagan was naive. He had this almost boyish naivete. He was surprised that I should find him strange. He was surprised, in fact, that I was interested in what was there inside him, because he was only interested in exterior things. So that was an example of the fact that I couldn't penetrate him by conventional means. But the real Ronald Reagan was revealed in the writings that he left behind. He was a copious writer, by the way, which people don't generally understand. A lucid, energetic, and copious writer. All his speeches before he became president, and indeed many of his speeches while he was president in the first term, he wrote out in his own patient, laborious handwriting. And being a writer, I can identify with script on the page. I can see the lucidity of his mind, the effortless sequences of his thoughts. And as I read these manuscripts, I realized this is a bright and formidable intellect.
Well, give us a sense of some of his writings as a young man and what you think those writings revealed about Ronald Reagan.
Oh, they're fascinating. Because as the writings of most young men are, they were full of unconscious self-portraits. Through all these stories, most of which are to do with young men wanting glory on the football field, or young men attracting girls as they work as lifeguards. In the midst of all these stories is this recognizable central figure. He's always tall, handsome, dreamy, attractive to women, but somehow aloof from them. This figure recurs again and again and again, and it's palpably the Ronald Reagan we saw in the White House.
No, are these short stories that you're talking about, or diary entries?
No, I'm talking about short stories and essays.
Mm-hmm.
He flattered himself when he was young. This is, his early college years, the period between, 1927 and 1932. He rather flattered himself that he was a good writer. And, in fact, he was. He had astonishing flights of imagination which come out in these short stories and which were later sublimated into his acting career. To give you one example, he describes the same ubiquitous, elegant, aloof, handsome young man coming back to college for his final senior year, getting off the bus, walking down the tree-shaded streets of this town, which is recognizably Eureka, Illinois. And as the young man walks down the street toward his frat house, he suddenly finds himself accompanied by his three earlier student selves, the freshman, the sophomore, and the junior. The freshman is callow and awkward in his clothes. The sophomore is slightly more sophisticated. The junior is recognizably a maturing young man. And now the senior is the splendid individual. And the leap of imagination for Ronald Reagan, at the age of 21, to think of himself in terms of a trio of doppelgangers is quite astonishing.
I don't actually find it that astonishing for someone who's trying to write fiction.
Well, it's an ingenious device. I've never seen that before. To be accompanied by three of oneself. We've often seen doppelganger literature where one talks about one's ghostly accompanist. But here Reagan, with supreme impartiality, is able to describe himself at three different stages of his life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you have access to Ronald Reagan's journals?
Yes, his diaries as president, I did. I read them all, from page one to page, four volumes. Four volumes.
And what would you say are among the most interesting things they revealed about him as a man and as a president?
The most interesting thing is the complete absence of ego and the omnipresent presence of id. He had this enormous sense of personal identity and righteousness, as I've said just now. But amazingly, he had no ego. I've never read anybody's diary without being aware of the presence of the ego. But Reagan had none. In many ways, the diaries are deeply uninteresting because they have no particular insights into the personalities of any of the people that he met, no curiosity about what was going on around him, no self-analysis, no self-doubt, none of the things that generally make diaries fascinating. But when you read them through, you have this feeling of a huge, superbly engineered, supremely confident personality.
In what sense did he show no ego in these journals?
A total absence of self-congratulation. Any normal human being writing a diary in moments of triumph will express triumph on the page. Self-satisfaction, self-congratulation. Reagan just didn't think that way. The only thing which does strike you as you read them is the conscientiousness with which he tabulates how many times he was interrupted by applause in all his speeches. He would say, speech in Miami, Florida went fine today. I had three SOs, three standing ovations. I was interrupted by 17 bursts of applause. And superficially, this might seem to be conceited note-taking, but actually it was not. It's the self-observation of a total professional checking out the effectiveness of his own performance.
My guest is Edmund Morris, author of the new biography of Ronald Reagan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Edmund Morris is my guest, the author of the new authorized biography of Ronald Reagan called Dutch, a Memoir. How is his memory when you started interviewing him? Ronald Reagan has had Alzheimer's for the past few years. You started speaking with him in 1985 for this book. How is his memory then? Do you think that he had any signs of early Alzheimer's at that point?
Absolutely not. To me, Alzheimer's is dementia. It is bizarre thought processes, strange, illogical verbal statements. Reagan never lost his lucidity. What he did lose, as time went on, was the energy to concentrate entirely on events all through the day, every day. Like many old men who have had severe medical traumas, he conserved himself, and in his second term, he quite often spaced himself out. Whenever he was required to be active and to lead and to change and to negotiate, he came back with all his facilities. But I would like to talk about his memory, since I remember you using that word to begin with.
Yeah, please.
Reagan's memory was photographic and phonographic, which is to say, he remembered things with photographic accuracy, things that he'd seen, but even more impressively, he remembered things phonographically in the sense that he registered sound. He really was almost like a tape recorder in that respect. And there was an extremely dramatic example of that in the office, Oval Office one day when I was interviewing him about his youth in Des Moines, Iowa. And I was actually trying to find out about his sex life as a young man, so I said to him, "What sort of things did you do at night, Mr. President, when you had time off?" And he said, "Oh, I used to go to the advertising club in Des Moines because that was the locale where we had the best speakers from out of town. And I would sit there listening to these speakers, and I learned a lot of the tricks of my trade from listening to those people." And he said, as a matter of fact, I remember one guy who came in from out of town who was presented to us as the chief executive of a toilet paper company. And he stood up and gave us a presentation about the manufacture of toilet paper, which was very witty and very funny. And it was only after a while we realized that it was actually a put-on. He was a professional comedian, and it was supposed to be a joke. So I'm sitting there listening to Reagan saying this. And Reagan says, as a matter of fact, I can remember every word of it today. And I said, you can, Mr. President? He said, yeah. He said, sometime when you've got time, I'll tell you about it. I said, oh, no, tell me now, please. I have this on tape. And his face changed. His eyes went dull. He inflated his lungs. His voice became high-pitched. And out of his mouth pours about 12 minutes of word-for-word recitation of the speech he heard once in 1933, the Advertising Club of Des Moines. It was not particularly funny anymore by conventional standards. This is what passed for humor in 1933, but what was uncanny was the way it poured out of him, almost as though he was a recording machine. And when he got to the end of this, I said in stupefaction, Mr. President, did you get a copy of his script and memorize it? And he said, oh, no, I've never thought about that until this moment.
Okay, well, that's one example of his memory. Let me tell you a story that was told to me here on Fresh Air when I was interviewing Michael Korda, who's the editor-in-chief of Simon & Schuster, and edited President Reagan's memoirs. And Michael Korda was saying that the president was a great storyteller, but the problem was that being an actor, over the years, he tended to put himself more and more in the foreground of the story. And I'll quote Michael Korda here. He said, thus, Reagan put himself more and more in the foreground of the story. He told Yitzhak Rabin and everybody else that he'd been the first American to reach Buchenwald, the Nazi death camp, and see the horrors of the concentration camps. And when he told Rabin, Rabin burst into tears because the story was so wonderful and so moving. The only problem is, when we put it in the book, we discovered that it wasn't true. Ronald Reagan, of course, had never been outside the United States in the Second World War and spent the entire Second World War in Culver City editing footage from military photographers. He had seen the footage of American troops liberating Buchenwald, but over the years, as he told the story, he gradually moved himself into the foreground of the story, and so he was the one who liberated Buchenwald. Does this story jive with anything that you found with Ronald Reagan?
Yes, absolutely. But I take a much more a constructive view of it than Michael does. Although I must say, when I read Michael's account, I was convulsed with laughter. It's very funny. I have indeed asked Reagan about that myself, and let me tell you the essence of it. Reagan was the top bureaucratic officer at the first motion picture unit of the Army Air Forces in World War II. And in April of 1945... units of the first motion picture unit went into Ohrdruf and Buchenwald and Ravensbrück with Eisenhower's soldiers and photographed they produced the first raw film, documentary film, of the indescribable horrors that were inside. And this raw film was airlifted back to the United States for processing back in Culver City, where Reagan was adjutant. And as the officer on the base with the highest intelligence clearing, he had to sit every day watching this unimaginable footage unreeling in raw form on the screen in order to have it cut up and processed and sent to the Pentagon for General Arnold to view. So here's Ronald Reagan, a creature of the screen and a child of the screen, sitting there morning after morning viewing the raw reality of the Holocaust. I've seen some of this film myself, and I was sick for days afterwards. He saw it. He was so transformed by it that when he was demobbed a few months later, he actually snuck some of these reels out of the base and took them home with him to show to his sons when they respectively turned 14 years of old to communicate to them the essence of the Holocaust. Now, in these days of virtual reality, I ask you, was he seeing reality or was he not? I can quite believe that as far as he was concerned, he was there.
I don't know. I think we've all had the experience of being just terribly moved or disturbed by movies that we've seen, whether the movies are fiction or documentaries. But I'm not sure that that would excuse any of us from assuming that we were actually an important figure in that story and that we were the hero of that story, the first reporter to report on it. I mean...
No, I'm sorry, that's nonsense. He never presented himself as the hero of the story. He simply said that he was there as a witness. And occasionally when he told the story, he would say, I was there at the liberation of the camp. Absolutely, he never would have said that I was the leader of the liberation. But, I'm sorry, that's Michael's memory.
Uh-huh, but it doesn't bother you that he thought he was there and what he'd done was see the movie? I mean, that seems like a really big difference to me, being truly moved by what you've seen because you saw the documentation and actually believing you were there when you weren't either a reporter or a soldier during World War II.
I'm not defending him, Terry. I am describing him. I'm describing a mysterious man. What I'm saying is that his emotions at what he saw were utterly genuine and transformed his character to a permanent degree.
Edmund Morris is the author of the new biography of Ronald Reagan. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Bantam Books, publishers of A Man in Full by Tom Wolfe, the author of Bonfire of the Vanities, in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Edmund Morris about his controversial new biography of Ronald Reagan. Also, John Peterman, founder of the J. Peterman Catalog, explains how his business went bankrupt and tells us what it was like to have a character based on him on Seinfeld.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Edmund Morris, author of the controversial new biography of Ronald Reagan. Now, your biography of Reagan starts at Bitburg, the German cemetery in which members of the SS were buried. He was
He was
urged to not speak there, and through speaking there, honor the SS who were buried there. So I'm wondering why you start your biography of him at Bitburg and what that story signifies in your larger biography.
Because that was the moment, the precise moment when I realized I just had to write this book. When I sat, like millions of other citizens around the world, watching Ronald Reagan coming out of the Documenten House at the induction center at Bergen-Belsen, looking around him at the green field of Bergen-Belsen, absolutely ravaged by what he'd just seen, these photographs inside the house, and having to step forward and articulate one of the truly great speeches of his presidency. I remember him coming out of that house, looking at the gray sky, and I remember hearing through the soundtrack of my television the cheep of a German Lerch, a skylark. And I don't know what it was. It's a combination of the gray sky and the expression on his face and the sound of that bird and the poignance of that moment. That's when I realized this is a huge moral drama that has been enacted here on the green field of Bergen-Belsen. And God, I wish I was there to describe this.
And what was the moral drama?
The moral drama was the conflict of memory between the Judaic religion and the Christian religion. Ronald Reagan, in a primitive way, was a simple, totally believing Christian. And to him, the idea of forgiveness and forgetting was a paramount part of the Christian faith. He felt that after 40 years, the Holocaust could at last be forgotten, put an end to, and we should go forward to bright new fields and a new tomorrow. That is the Christian sentimentality, that the past can be transcended. The Jews know that the past can never be forgotten. So it was a conflict between the two basic sentiments of Judaism and Christianity. Enormously dramatic, perfect for literature, and it is that kind of moral drama that I wanted to write about and make the center core of this biography.
What do you think he decided to speak at Bitburg, because of forgiveness?
He was asked to do this by Chancellor Kohl, Helmut Kohl of West Germany, who begged him in the Oval Office, literally with tears in his eyes, to make a gesture of reconciliation to the German people. And he said, in effect, to the president, this is the end of 1984, will you come to Germany on the 40th anniversary of the end of World War II, and will you clasp hands with me at some field where our soldiers lie buried, so that we can finally put to an end the ancient divisions that have divided us. And Reagan just loved that kind of notion and committed himself to going. When the decision to go to Bitburg was announced in the spring of 1985, and it was discovered that this cemetery at Bitburg contained, amongst other graves, the graves of SS members, all hell broke loose. Jews across the world were outraged that the President of the United States should be going to Germany and do honor to the perpetrators of the concentration camps. And this outcry developed, led most eloquently by Elie Wiesel, "Mr. President," to quote Wiesel's words, "that is not your place, you must not go there." And Reagan, withstanding the first major crisis of his presidency, obstinately insisted on going forward and keeping his commitment, which he did do, but the palliative that he offered, was persuaded to offer, was to go to Bergen-Belsen as well, and that's where this great drama took place.
My guest is Edmund Morris, and his new biography of Ronald Reagan has just been published, and it's an authorized biography of the former president. Because Ronald Reagan so emphasized family values, I'm interested in his family. You describe his father as, quote, a shoe salesman, lapsed Catholic, wanderer, and binge drinker. What kind of relationship did they have?
Reagan, my impression was that he secretly disapproved of his father, in the sense, although he had an affection for him, but he disapproved of his father's weakness. Reagan was a very strong man, and he admired strength in other people. Therefore, he admired his very strong mother. He admired strong men and strong women. He saw weakness in his father, and he had a deep moral disapproval of that.
Now, you know, you write about how between marriages to Jane Wyman and Nancy Davis, he had a lot of girlfriends in Hollywood. You write, "My research cards show him stepping out with at least 16 different young and beautiful actresses, from Doris Day and Rhonda Fleming to Piper Laurie. He did admit once to sleeping with so many girls that the morning came when he did not know who one of them was. I'll discreetly leave it at that." Did his life jive with the values that he professed and the legislation that he supported in terms of, you know, family values?
That was the interstice between his two marriages, and he certainly covered the waterfront and used to talk about it quite frankly later. I remember Bob Novak I bumped into the other day, the columnist, and he was telling me that he took a plane ride with Reagan in 1976 and spent 2 hours with him, and the future president spent all that time telling him about those wild years in Hollywood when he was sleeping with a lot of extraordinarily gorgeous women. So Ronald Reagan was a real man and a real guy. However, he was almost pathologically faithful when he was married. He was uxorious and faithful and old-fashioned and traditional.
But still, the way that he slept with a lot of women in between marriages seems to be exactly one of the kind of things he would have been very moralistic about in his years in the White House.
That's true, but many horny young men become moralistic later on in life. He became quite prudish as president. He didn't like sex on the screen, got very upset about it. He had a surprising enjoyment of really lusty male jokes, but it had to be in male company only. He got very embarrassed if anybody told a faintly risque joke in front of women. In that way, he was almost touchingly old-fashioned. He would blush and be very embarrassed.
What kind of father was he?
He was an almost absentee father. When he was with his children, which was infrequently, for example, young Michael, the one who was most starved for parental affection, young Michael had his father every Saturday afternoon during his teenage years at the ranch. And Michael told me very touchingly once, he said, "Those afternoons were those wonderful moments of my life. But for the 6.5 days in between those afternoons, his father was totally absent." So all the children, in their respective fashion, to this day, you can sense their starvation for this large, lovable, magical man who was hardly ever with them. He was always away on the road for General Electric or on the set for movies or in the State House as governor and in the White House as president. He was always doing the business of the world and had very little time for them.
You write, "In one respect, Ron and Nancy were model parents, and that was at family photo opportunities."
Yes, absolutely. There are comical moments when Patty Davis would say to him, in the later stages when the family had reached the point of dysfunctionality, she would say to him, "Dad, don't you understand, you know, my traumas as a teenager, and you never knew about them because Mommy wouldn't tell you about them." And he would say, "But Patty, we were so happy as a family. Look at all those Christmas pictures. We look so happy together." He identified the annual family Christmas picture as evidence that it was a happy family, whereas anything but. I'm sorry to say that as I talk to you now, three of his children are totally alienated from their mother.
You mean not on speaking terms?
Yes, they just do not communicate. Ron and Patty and Michael. Although I think Michael does go around to see her occasionally, but it's a very stiff relationship.
Did they also cut off relations with their father?
Oh, no, no, they adore him still. And they try to see him when they can, and it's not easy for them.
Mm-hmm. After having completed Ronald Reagan's biography, are you still left with some of the impressions that you started with, that this was a man who was intellectually limited, a man who wasn't reflective, a man who was a cultural yahoo, is the word you once used?
Oh, no, I don't think that he ever changed in that respect. Culture did not darken his door in the later years of his life. He never showed any great curiosity about the characters and the opinions of people around him. In that sense, he was limited. But they were the obvious signs of his greatness. This man was concerned only with large matters of consequence for the entire country. And he was not concerned with ordinary simplicities.
Of course, his policies affected culture, even though he wasn't interested or concerned with it.
That's true, that's true. He had no particular admiration for the fine arts or need for it. His own aesthetic sensibilities, insofar as he had any, were almost comically primitive. I mean, his idea of a transcendent piece of art would be a ghastly leather cutout of a cowboy jogging along against a background of cutout leather mountains, or pictures of horses in his ranch hanging slightly crooked. That was his idea of aesthetic bliss.
Well, Edmund Morris, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Ms. Grice. It's a pleasure.
Edmund Morris is the author of the new biography of Ronald Reagan. Coming up, The Real J. Peterman. This is Fresh Air. John Peterman is best known for two things, the J. Peterman catalog, which he created, and the character of Peterman on Seinfeld, which was based on him. Peterman became a character at the end of the sixth season in 1995. Here's the scene in which he first appeared. Elaine, who is out of work, is walking down a New York street through the rain, crying about losing her manicurist, when she runs into J. Peterman, played by John O'Hurley.
That's a very nice jacket.
Oh,
very soft. Huge button flaps, cargo pockets, drawstring waist, deep bi swing vents in the back, perfect for jumping into a gondola.
How do you know all that?
That's my coat.
You mean?
Yes. I'm J. Peterman.
Peterman ends up hiring Elaine as a copywriter for his catalog after she impresses him with her adventurous prose. The catalog copy is part of what made The Real J. Peterman famous. Instead of straightforward descriptions of the products focusing on colors and dimensions, the J. Peterman catalog offered flowery descriptions in romantic language, emphasizing the exotic locales the products originated from. As the catalog business got more successful, Peterman branched out into retail stores, but the business went bankrupt early this year. Peterman explains why in the current edition of the Harvard Business Review. The company has been sold to the women's retailer Paul Harris Stores, which now owns the J. Peterman trade name and runs the J. Peterman website. Before we discuss the bankruptcy, let's find out why John Peterman wanted such romanticized descriptions in his catalog.
I was told by many experts that people won't read long copy. They don't have the time. Just give them the price and tell them what it is and then move on. And that's what the catalog business is all about. Well, I wasn't sure that people would read long, interesting copy, but I knew that they wouldn't read short, boring copy, and that's why they didn't read copy. So we decided right from the very beginning to write long copy that told a story about each product and felt that people would read it. We actually buried the price within the copy so that people wouldn't just look at the price, they'd read the copy.
I guess that's good because the prices were pretty high.
Well, yes. We sold to an upper income, upper educational level customer who would appreciate the uniqueness, the authenticity, the romance of the particular items that we were selling. However, we also had a lot of very price competitive things, but we also had a lot of very expensive things. And if you want something that is truly unique and authentic, sometimes it costs a lot of money. And that was another thing that I was told that you absolutely could not do was sell a $3,000 sofa in a catalog.
Did you sell a lot of those $3,000 sofas?
Not in sheer numbers, but in dollars. If you sell 10 sofas, that's $30,000, and on a page in a small circulation catalog, that's good. And we also had a shirt that I found in Otavalo in Ecuador called the Otavalo shirt, strangely enough. And that sold for $29. And it was a peasant shirt. I bought it. I actually bought it off the back of a fellow, of an Ecuadorian in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, you think that one of the reasons why your company had to declare bankruptcy was that you grew too big. What was the plan that you think basically ruined your business?
There were several aspects and I'll take you through it very, very quickly. In 1995, there was a huge increase in paper prices. Paper prices went up about 40%, and there was a large increase in postage prices. They went up about 17%. And we had been growing rapidly, $10 million a year, 30, 40% a year up until that point. And when those paper and postage prices increases came in, we actually lost money in 1995. And our response rates seemed to decrease a little bit. And so I thought that, well, it seems as though that we've reached a kind of ceiling or a level of the niche of for the owner's manual and what we do. Intuitively, I knew that this niche was far bigger because all people like romance, authenticity, excellence, wondrous journey. They like all of those things. And I said, we're just not able to reach them with this medium. So my thought was in 1995 that in order for the business to attain its potential, that we should expand more rapidly into retail.
Open up stores.
Open up stores. And there was ample evidence to say that 4 out of 4 people shopped out of retail stores, 1 out of 4 people at the time shopped out of catalogs. So there was a far larger market. And, of course, the question was, how are you ever going to transfer the ambiance and the charisma of the catalog into a retail setting? And just as all the experts told me that I couldn't use art and long copy in the catalog and make it work, I felt that I could make it work in a retail setting, which we did. We were able to transfer the ambiance and the charisma and the romance and the uniqueness of the catalog into retail settings. So additionally to that, I had pressure from venture capitalists that, you're going to have to reinvent yourself. You've hit the ceiling. How are we going to get our money back, et cetera, et cetera? So my thought at the time was that, okay, going into retail was a way to grow the business and still maintain who we were, but get bigger.
What are some of the problems you ran into once you got bigger, maybe too big?
Several things went wrong. There are two theories of organizational development in a growing company. One theory is that you grow the business and the organization lags behind. And the other theory is that you build the organization for the anticipated sales to come. The danger with the first theory of having your organization lag behind is that when the growth comes, you may not be prepared to handle it with your organization and the company crumbles from within. The danger with the second scenario of building the organization in anticipation of the growth that is to come is that the growth doesn't come and you're stuck with a very high overhead, and that causes a lack of money, or what's known as a liquidity crisis. And that's exactly what happened to the J. Peterman Company, is that we had developed a large, expensive organization in anticipation of the growth, and we never quite got to the point where that growth kicked in.
My guest is John Peterman, founder of the J. Peterman Catalog. His company declared bankruptcy early this year and then was bought by another company. This is the same J. Peterman who became the basis of a character on Seinfeld. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Peterman, the founder of the J. Peterman Catalog. This is the same Peterman who became the basis of a character on Seinfeld. The catalog declared bankruptcy early this year. There's a character based on you in Seinfeld, you know, who had the J. Peterman Catalog, and Elaine on Seinfeld wrote copy for the catalog. How do you think that affected the business while you were still in business?
A good question, and 70% of the people who watched Seinfeld didn't realize that we were a real company when it hit in 95 and 96. The customers who were buying from us and knew about us and saw it on Seinfeld, saw it amusing, but didn't make them buy any more than they were already buying. And people who didn't know that we were a real catalog didn't rush to us, you know, and find out that we were real. So it really didn't affect business at the time. What it was doing was building name recognition to be taken advantage of at a later date over a period of time. I declined, as I said in the article, to commercialize Seinfeld and J. Peterman, i.e. run ads saying the real J. Peterman, etc. I wanted to let it set in over time, have it be a discovery for people that, my God, it's a real company. And no, he's nothing like John O'Hurley, who played me on Seinfeld.
You're not?
No, but John and I are friends. He's a great, great guy, and he's funny, and he's wonderful, but it's just not me.
How did you find out that there was going to be a character based on you on Seinfeld?
I was taking the red eye back from Los Angeles, and I got into the office the next morning, and they said, you were on Seinfeld last night. And, you know, I always get accused of being in nefarious places. And I said, no, I wasn't. I said, I have proof I was on their plane. And so I saw the tape, and that was the first I knew about it. They didn't ask or anything else. And then I guess the soup Nazi sued them. He was on at the same time. And so I got a call from the lawyers, and I guess their lawyers went to Seinfeld and said, maybe you better talk to Peterman before you proceed with this. So I said, sure, that's fine. And I used to sign off on the scripts about 6 weeks before they went on.
So
and I never changed any of the
scripts. You never changed any?
Uh-huh. No.
Did you see that your character on Seinfeld as being a compliment? Or did you think that they were mocking you in the catalog?
They were Seinfelding me. And that's what their show was based on. That's what their art was. And I did not consider it a compliment. I did not consider it an insult. I used to watch the shows sometimes when I was on there, and I would laugh right along with it. I guess my ego doesn't run that way. It must run in another form. But I never was embarrassed or insulted about it, and I was never got a big head about it either.
Now you did add an Elaine Benes suit to the J. Peterman catalog.
Right.
Just describe the suit and why you added it.
It was just a tailored woman's suit. But as I said in the article, that was a little crack. We did it just kind of to wink at Seinfeld, mm-hmm. and to wink at the consumer and to wink at Elaine. And normally when we wink at somebody, they normally sue us. But I guess she forgot that or remembered that I didn't sue them. So it was a quid pro quo. But I was looking at it as a wink.
After going bankrupt, do you still love the idea of being in business, or does all the risk of business now not seem quite as exciting and seem a little more frightening?
No, I still like the romance of being in business. Now, will my next business tie me up with things that I'm not talented in? No. Am I a risk taker by nature? Yes. I mean, that's what drives me forward. That's why I go some of the places in the world that I go to. I mean, that's what life is about, Terry. Life isn't, if you get knocked down, you make a mistake, and then you go away, you've stopped living life. And I think that there's just a huge amount more to live in life.
Well, John Peterman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Peterman, he explains how the J. Peterman Company went bankrupt in the current edition of the Harvard Business Review. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Prudick. Dorothy Ferriby is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Crown, publishers of the new book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home and Other Unexplained Powers of Animals by Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. And from Bantam Books, publishers of A Man in Full by Tom Wolfe, the author of Bonfire of the Vanities, in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, screenwriter and director Audrey Wells. Her new movie, Guinevere, starring Sarah Polley and Stephen Ray, looks at the romance between a young woman and an older man and the needs that bring them together. Wells also wrote the screenplay for The Truth About Cats and Dogs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.